So tonight, today, this afternoon, wherever it is you are in the world, we will be hearing from Dennis Teeth. Dennis is part of the NA Fellowship. I see him quite a bit at different meetings. I always love what he has to say. Actually, that's a lie. Sometimes I don't like it because the truth hurts. But either way, he's got a good message. So let's give it up for Dennis. It's all yours, and thank you for your service.
Oh, I can unmute. Okay. Yeah. Thanks, Marcia. My name is Dennis, and I'm an addict. And I was definitely looking forward to this because I'd come across a series of coincidences in my life in the last few years. And I had been adopted into an Irish Catholic family in New York in 1947. I was 13 days old. I never knew my mother. And in those days, when you were adopted, you never got to know your mother. You know what I mean? That was it. You couldn't trace them down. You couldn't ask questions. You couldn't do. My father never hid anything. My adopted father, of course, never hid anything from me at all. I knew, always knew that I was adopted, which hurt. But, I got past it. I had a mother now, and everything was cool. And she passed away when I was four and a half. My first difficulty with religion, as they were Irish Catholics, and she couldn't undergo a surgery, which is understandable. They had been married for 12 years, had no children, and then they adopted me. A year and a half later, they adopted my half sister, which I didn't find out until she was a half sister until a few years ago. But and then she got pregnant, which was wonderful. I mean, it was amazing. Everybody was ecstatic. And then she got I guess it was stomach cancer or uterine cancer. It was called stomach cancer in those days, and she wouldn't have the surgery because she would have lost the baby. So essentially, my adopted mother then, in the eyes of a child, okay, gotta remember that. That's what I was, four years old, three and a half, 4 years old, and she decided to die rather than to lose the child, which was a bitter pill for me in those days. So whatever, I felt abandoned and abandoned and abandoned and whatever, so that. I can remember when I was about seven or eight when life became dark. That's the only thing I can categorize it as. I remember that distinctly. Life became dark. I had been an absolute straight A student until that time. And then I started to slowly, my grades slowly started to slip. And since I had started reading when I was three, and I was reading scholastic tomes by the time I was five, which is absurd, but it's true. So I was a little bit ahead of the rest of the class, and I was expected to excel. And it went sideways, it went backwards from that point. And I was terribly easily distracted. I probably had any of a half a dozen different things that they could figure out today, or medications that could have been applied. In those days, there wasn't anything, I was just a troubling kid, and I was intellectually lazy. That was my first label. I was really smart, and I wouldn't cooperate, Well, by the time I was, I think I was seven or younger, possibly. I learned how to steal books because they couldn't keep up with me. I couldn't take enough books from the library. I couldn't find enough books at home. I couldn't, I needed more books. So I learned to steal comic books at that point. But by the time I was 7 years old, for sure, I was stealing science fiction books. That was my next thing. So yeah, eventually, at age 10, I got, you know, the family was Irish Catholic again, another common theme. They all drank, you know, and, but they drank like gentlemen, except for my Uncle John. He was an alcoholic. Everybody talked about him kind of quietly, you know. John has a little trouble with the drink, yeah. So anyway, by age 10, I found, I can remember my first beer over behind the railroad tracks behind some parked boxcars. Clearly, distinctly remember drinking my very first beer. And of course I got loaded, you know what I mean? I was ecstatic. It was wonderful, fucking fabulous, boy. It was the greatest thing that ever happened. And I quickly became a pretty regular weekend drunk, which was remarkable at that age, frankly. And it proceeded from there. We didn't have drugs in the neighborhood, even in the Bronx where I grew up. There were no druggies in the neighborhood in those days. But shortly after that, I first heard about the first ones, the first two that I'd ever heard of, I became good friends with one of them, you know. And I jumped in feet first. He was smoking weed and shooting heroin, you know. So that was a revelation. That was like astonishing. I mean, Jesus Christ Almighty. I can remember feeling that the sun rose in the back of my head. The sun came right up out of the ground in the back of my head. It was fucking incredible, unbelievable. And scared the dog shit right out of me because it was too good. You know, it really was. It was fucking too good. It was, you know, it terrified me. So I tried to stay away from that. And at that point, I found somebody had some speed. And of course, in those days, again, in 66, 65, 67, somewhere in that area, speed wasn't addictive. You know, your speed, methadone, not addictive. That's what they thought, you know. So, yeah, so I first became actually, frankly, strung out after I gave up alcohol at about 16, 17. I found speed and I quickly became a speed freak. And that persisted. I was using everything else I could get my hands on also, but that was my mainstay. And I used that for 7 years, at the end of which time I had managed to lose my job, lose my place I was staying at, lose pretty much lose just about everything, and I had been reduced to driving a cab. I had actually, believe it or not, failed out of college at 18 or 19, 18, I think it was 19, and went back home. I was in Albany, New York, and then I went back home to the Bronx after I failed out of college, and I was home for 6 weeks. My father said, "You got to get a job or you got to move." So about 2 weeks later, I hadn't gotten a job, and he said, "Well, listen, there's a civil service test coming up. I want you to take that." I said, "Oh, great. I'll be a fireman." He said, "No." I said, "What?" He said, no. He says, it's a test for the police department." I thought, "I'm only 18 or 19. I can't be a cop, you know." He said, no. He says, "They'll put you on as a police trainee and you just work in the precinct answering phones and stuff." I said, "Oh, fuck it. You know, why not?" So I could always take tests. That's how I managed to get as far as college. I would fail for the year on the school's test scores, but we had a double standard in New York. You could have, you have the school tests, and then you had what they call the Regents exams put out by the state. And the Regents exams were very, very tough. They were unbelievably difficult. And I would fucking ace them every year. And then if you pass the Regents, just you're in, baby. You didn't matter what the fuck you had. I had a 42 average in history in the sophomore year. I got a 98 on the fucking Regents, scored by the guy who hated my fucking guts for the 40 with the 42 average. And he said, I took a point off of penmanship and a point off of composition. I couldn't figure out how to take any more points off. So you got a 98. He hated me anyway. So that was the high school career. And I got out of high school, and I even got into college because, again, I aced the fucking tests, you know, the scholastic exams and all that shit. And I got a semi-scholarship to the fucking college, which is ridiculous, but it's, you know, facts. I was still a drunk in those days, really, pretty much. But I'd found speed. So I went up to college, and I didn't get any speed up there, but I had, had plenty of fucking booze in Albany, which I found. And at the end of that semester, I had failed out of college due to absence. I had stopped going to the fucking classes. I got pissed off again over religion in a history class because I knew more of fucking history than the fucking teacher. Anyway, so that was my story. And, you know, I come home and I could take this fucking civil service exam, which I fucking aced, of course. And I fucking became a police trainee. And I was loaded as a wolf most of the time when I was. But, you know, in those days, they still had that blue wall, even in New York, even after Serpico, which hadn't been too many years prior. I knew the fly captain who ran Serpico. Frankly, I met him. Anyway, so comes 21 years old. Bingo. I'm a fucking New York cop. Pop. I go through the academy, which I actually had to go through twice because they weren't satisfied with the scores the first time, but they didn't want to get rid of us. It was a bunch of us. And they put us through twice. And most of us passed and became cops. And but we were all dope fiends in one form or another, that whole group. And years later, I was reading a book, which I read. Fuck, I read like a fucking, like people eat. And I come across a line in the book, and they're talking about the bad class who came out of the police academy. And I knew who the fuck they were talking about, you know? So that was me, yeah. So I became a cop in the 42nd precinct in the Bronx. And my father was one of 12. My mother was one of 15. And one of my mother's brother-in-laws, George Primrose, was a precinct captain in Western, Upper West New York, Upper West, not the Upper West Side, but the West Side of the Bronx. And he was a precinct captain in the 48th precinct. And the system in the police department works by what you call who's your rabbi. In other words, who you got looking out for you, you know? And I wasn't dead 2 days, and every motherfucker in the place already knew that George Primrose was my uncle. So they never did fuck with me. Never did fuck with me. I grew a great big handlebar mustache, came to work. Every fucking day I went to work, I was loaded and stayed loaded for 3 years. And then and almost got busted a few times, but they'd come into the fucking place I was at and they'd say, this is an arrest, you know, you're under, we're all under arrest. Raise your hands. So I knew what to do. I said, Sergeant. He says, who's that? I said, Sergeant, I got a gun. He says, what? He says, I've got a gun. He says, I'm a cop. You know, he says, oh, shit. He turns around. He says, okay, everybody get the fuck out of here. This is over. We'll see you all later. Now you get the fuck out of here, and I don't want to see you or hear from you again. Anyway, so that was my career as a cop. I finally got busted in Jersey for drugs, and then I lost my job as a New York cop. And that was the end of my speed, too. Speed had such a terrible effect on me after 7 years of nonstop speed, using speed. I had a form of tardive dyskinesia. If you any of you know what that is, your face, you know, the muscles in your face stop working properly. It's like Bell's palsy, but it's temporary. And what happened to me was I couldn't just smile for 2 fucking years, right? Yeah. So I was pretty smart about that. I quit speed, you know, but I kept using everything else for another 12 fucking years, you know. Genius at work, of course. Anyway. So I used everything in the fucking PDR and everything that was available in the street period. And lived in Greenwich Village, lived in Fleabag fucking hotels, $15 a week in New York years ago. It was, what they call the welfare hotels. Panhandled. I was good for $60 a night panhandling. And that was a shit pot full of money in those days. Let me tell you, we'd go to, I went to a Grateful Dead concert when in the Fillmore East in New York. And it was like $7 for a fucking ticket to see the Grateful Dead. That's how long ago that was, really. And we went in at 7 o'clock, got out at 5:30 a.m., broad daylight, bright broad daylight. Fucking Dead played all night long. Unbelievable. They came back 3 times because the audience refused to stop applauding and screaming. And they came back. Fucking amazing shit. Absolutely incredible. So anyway, that was the highlights. There was so many lowlights, it's not even worth talking about. By this time, I was so fucked up. The only women who would talk to me were hookers. And that's all they would do is talk by this time. I was fucked up pretty bad. I managed to forget to take a bath one winter. Not a good idea, I promise you. So when I did take the bath at the end of the winter, I had to scrape the garbage out of the goddamn tub with a chunk of cut a box up and scoop it out with a box. Had to clean it and drain it 3 different times before it would drain. Fucked up. Yes, I was fucked up. Yes. And, came out of that was driving a gypsy cab by this time in New York. A bunch of guys from my old neighborhood, younger than me, but they decided they wanted to leave New York. And I couldn't get away from fucking heroin no matter what I did. I moved and got new jobs, got new clothes, new friends, new neighborhoods. And 3 months later, I was shooting dope again. So, you know, there was no way out. And I figured, well, you guys are leaving, huh? They said, yeah. I said, where the hell are you going? I had tried to leave 3 times. And go to fucking Haight-Ashbury, right? That was my dream. And every fucking time I went to Haight-Ashbury, I either woke up in jail or I went to jail, period. Every fucking time. So I says, you guys are leaving? They says, yeah, we're leaving. I says, where are you going? Florida. Oh, hey, Al, can I go with you? You know, no, I'm not going to fucking jail again. So then I went to Florida. I spent 4 years in Fort Lauderdale. And they got lots of heroin in Fort Lauderdale, let me tell you. And I found those. Goddamn, the Lord. Yeah, boy, oh boy. Anyway, I left Florida 4.5 years later when the bottom fell out of the construction business. I'd been working construction, and there wasn't any fucking work to be had in Florida. So I hitchhiked to New Orleans, and I sat in New Orleans. It was a fucking incredible place. It was a phenomenal place. Fantastic place. I couldn't say enough about it. It was just a dream. And I loved it, you know. It was the craziest place I'd ever been in my life. And 3 years into that, I met a girl, a local girl, and got married. She had a three-year-old daughter. And then we had two more kids. And about 5 years in, 4 years in, she had gotten a job working in a treatment center. And I had gotten back into, I had found a fucking cocaine by that point. And I saw on top of the heroin. So the cocaine was bringing me back to the same horse shit that I could, it was just like fucking speed. Okay. It was the same rack of shit that the speed had got me into. So, I said to my wife, thinking that, I didn't believe in the program. I knew it didn't work. My Uncle John never could stay clean. He had been in AA for like 30, 40 years and could never stay clean, you know. So I knew it was bullshit that didn't work, but I needed a rest. You know, I needed to get away from this fucking shit. I always say, tell people cocaine ruined my fucking using. And I went into the treatment center. It took them 2 weeks to convince me that I was an addict. I mean, I had been shooting dope for 17 years. I'd been getting loaded for 28 years at that point. And my trick was that I could kick, you know, that's how I managed to use for that length of time. By every time I would get a slight habit, I would kick, you know, and I did it 10, 12 times, maybe more. So I wasn't like the real addicts, you know what I mean? They could never kick. I had plenty of friends who shot dope 24/7, 365, and they never, ever could kick. And, you know, most of the time they would just disappear after a while and I would have to find new friends, you know what I mean? They were either dead or in jail or whatever. So I was desperate not to let that happen to me. And I kept, you know, I kept it at bay by kicking every so often. But, you know, the thing was about that, I learned something. I learned that no matter what I did, no matter how many times I kicked, I always wound up, 3, 4, 5, 6 months later, whatever it was, in an abandoned building, in a staircase, by candlelight, shooting dope by myself, thinking, holy fuck, how did this happen again? You know? So I learned, you know, that whenever you kick, when you go back, not only do you go back, but when you go back, it's worse than it was before, you know? So I went into this treatment center, and 2 weeks in, this woman doctor who was an addict, an ex-addict, a recovered addict, explained the situation. She says, what you were doing, she says, you know, you're the only one that can decide if you're an addict or not. She says, but what you're doing is called protecting your addiction, making sure you'll be able to use again later. And the thing was that I had actually had the exact same thought myself. And I recognized that she actually knew what she was talking about. But, you know, I also had bad experiences in treatment. They had a great meeting in the big hall one day, and there was like 45 addicts in treatment. And all the counselors were in the front of the room, and they decided to ask people questions. And the first question they asked was, what was the first thing you were addicted to? So I thought about it. It took me about 2 seconds and I raised my hand. And they said, oh, what was the first thing you were addicted to? I said, sex, because that was the first thing I could get my hands on that, you know, that actually gave me trouble. I mean, I used that motherfucker till it was bleeding, you know what I mean? On a regular basis. And so I knew, I recognized that clearly. And then at that point, the counselor in the room said, wait a minute, you can't be addicted to sex. And I thought, holy fucking shit, here I am desperate to try and save my ass. And the fuckers running the place don't even know what the fucking disease is about. Boy, oh boy, oh boy. This is a world of shit. So it made it difficult for me to wrap my head around the idea that the program was absolutely serious. Then the first asshole I asked to be my sponsor, I called him every day for the first, the first 6 weeks, called him every day. And he never answered the fucking phone one fucking time, not once. And after that, I called him like every few days, maybe once a week. And then I finally stopped calling him. Then I ran into him in a meeting. 6 months later, I had picked this group in the treatment center, no less, to be my home group. And it was the oldest meeting in New Orleans at that point, called Stone Free. And it was kind of decrepit. Half the time I was the only home group member there. You know, it was a real small meeting, maybe 6-8 people at the most, 10 people, maybe once in a great while. So in he walks and he's got a fucking sponsee with him, a brand new kid, you know? And I'm thinking, Jesus Christ, not only does he show up, he doesn't even say hello to me. I got to talk to him. And he's got a new guy with him, but he wouldn't talk to me. What the fuck, you know? And then he says, oh, listen, he says, we have to have an emergency business meeting after the meeting. And I said, well, okay, sure. He's got a lot of time. He had 2 years, you know, it's fucking amazing. And so we have this fucking business meeting and I'm the only home group member there, him and the new guy. Now, the thing was, anybody could vote in our business meetings, you know. He says, well, he says, I've got it on good authority that this facility, this hospital is getting a tax write-off because there's an NA meeting on the grounds. And I thought, that don't smell right, you know? And we're going to have a vote as to whether we close this meeting or not. You know, he says, it's breaking traditions. So we have to close this. I vote we close this meeting. And the newcomer says, okay, I vote that way too. And that's it. The fucking meeting is dead. So the asshole shows up and closes my fucking first home group down. And I asked him, I said, why don't you answer the goddamn phone? He says, I ain't got time for that shit. I thought, Jesus fucking Christ. This is a fucking program going to save my life, right? Yeah. Oh, yeah, 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 yeah. So anyway, I didn't have good experiences early in recovery, but I did recognize clearly that I needed to stay clean. And then I did enjoy being clean and being around people in the rooms, but I had my doubts. You know, I sure as hell didn't like religion. The girl I married had a history of abuse by her grandfather and then a bunch of Catholic priests, you know, and they didn't stop with my old lady. They had wrecked the lives of about a dozen or more addicts who were in the rooms in one whole fucking family, which I won't name. Well-known family was riddled with fucking people who were being abused by priests. And they were all crazier than dog shit. You know what I mean? They had been really fucked up by it. So that plus my early experiences, my family was Irish Catholic, but they actually were raised in Scotland, which is a vastly Protestant country, mostly Protestant country. And they had to fight every day on the way to school, walking past the public school or Protestant school, whatever you want to call it. And then coming home, they had to fight on the way back home. It was nuts, you know, and I'm thinking, this is fucking religion? What the fuck? You know, this is crazy. I can remember being in catechism in like fifth or sixth grade or some shit. And the priest is telling us, yeah, we're the lucky few. He says, we've been gifted by God with the gift of faith. And I thought, wow, I got fucked. You know, I didn't get the gift of fucking faith. Anyway, so yeah, my experiences with religion were very negative. And the fucking teachers in school, you know, they used to beat the living shit out of us with rulers, with fucking hammer handles, with all kinds of shit. Or just slap the fuck out of us, you know, when we were, you know, and I was a real good target because I would just prop a book up in front of the, you know, on the guy in front of me in class, and I would read, you know, I wouldn't pay no attention. It was boring. It was like watching paint dry when it was already dry, you know, it was terrible. And so I was a big target, and they were pissed at me because I was intellectually lazy and all this shit. Anyway, bad experiences in school, all tied to being basically an addict even before I was using heavy drugs. So I came by that honestly. But when I went after I went through treatment in '84, I was clean for like 8 months. But during that period, I'd be walking down the street and I would stop and I would think and I would remember my connection's phone number. Oh, okay. I still got it. Okay. I'm good. You know, and then I would keep walking, you know, I really wasn't in recovery. I was around recovery. You know what I mean? I wasn't working a program. I didn't really believe in the goddamn program actually, or rather I knew it didn't work. That was even worse. And then I had this terrible relapse at 8 months. And it was really bad, really, really bad. I was using an insane amount of dope for about a month and change. Dope and fucking coke. And I was really fucked up. And at the end of that, and one day, I was absolutely positive my heart had stopped at least five times during that day. And I knew at the end of the day that I only had a day or two to live because I didn't want to stop. I didn't want to quit. And I knew it was going to kill me. And boy, that scared the Jesus fucking Christ out of me. It scared me so bad. Then I went back to a meeting, you know, I was shaking like a goddamn leaf when I got to the meeting. And that was the beginning, you know, January. It's between the 13th and the 17th. I could never figure out the date. So I just celebrated on January 17th of 85. And it was a very, 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 very fucking slow progress for me because I didn't believe in any of it, you know, not a fucking thing. I just identified with the other addicts in the room. I was comfortable around addicts, not around normal people. And I enjoyed just shooting my mouth off in meetings, you know, I thought it was enjoyable, you know. But I really thought it was nonsense that those, you know, bunch of crap, they were conning each other or, you know, whatever. And after about three years in, it was evident to me because I could see it in people I had met who had come into rooms after me and were getting well. They really were getting better. You know, I could see that the improvement in their lives and the improvement in their personalities. And some of these people were genuinely dangerous fucking lunatics. I mean, seriously, fucking very dangerous people. Still to this day, they still are. And some of them. And I could see them getting better. And I wasn't getting any better. I was still angry and crazy as shit. And of course, blaming everybody else wasn't my fault. I wasn't doing anything. I was doing everything right. I wasn't using. Leave me the fuck alone. I'm good. You know, don't bother me. And I was going to meetings, though. You know, it's the only game in town. And I started asking questions. So I asked people, what the hell is going on here? How the fuck is this happening? You know, what is this stuff that you're doing that's working? What exactly are you doing? You know, and they told me the standard shit. Going to meetings, calling the sponsor, which I still was having trouble with even at that point because of the terrible fucking experiences I had. I can't tell you how many people I asked to be a sponsor who said, no, I don't have time for anybody as crazy as you, which was genuine. It was well-deserved. I was nuts. But, you know, still, you know, I just didn't have any fucking luck with that. And the upshot of the questions was that they had no idea why any of this stuff was changing them or what it was that was working for them. They couldn't tell you for $1 million, no fucking clue. And I said, well, you know, it's obviously working, even though they don't have a fucking clue. So it's whatever the fuck they're doing that's working. They don't understand why, but I need some of that shit in my life. So I'm going to try to start doing it. Well, I was still operating under my own fucking operating system and not listening to other people, you know. So it still took a long fucking time. I mean, I was still under the I was still thinking like an addict, you know. And people wanted me to do service work at the fuck. What are you fucking nuts? Something I don't have to do. You want me to do extra fucking shit? You're out of your fucking mind. I'm a fucking addict. I don't know where you come from. You guys are fucking stupid. And so I didn't do any service work until I was 7 years clean. And then I got hoodwinked into it by some idiot. I went to a goddamn service meeting just to show up and see what they were doing. And I got volunteered to be vice chair of area. And then right after I get volunteered into this shit, the group that I'm they split off into a new fucking area. And I'm the vice chair. It's okay if you're vice chair. You don't have to know anything. You don't have to do anything. You just watch the chairperson for a year and then you become chairperson and you know what to do because you watched the chairperson for a year. Well, the girl who was chairperson was pregnant. 3 months down the line, she gets permanent bed rest for the rest of her pregnancy. And I'm the fucking chairperson. And this is a brand new area. We got to write guidelines. We got to do the entire goddamn thing, set up the whole son of a bitch. And I don't know anything. I got no experience, man, oh, man. Anyway, it was the best thing that ever happened to me in my whole life up to that point. And I got all that shit done with help from a lot of good people. And it changed me more in that 2 year period of being the vice chair and then the chair than I had changed in the previous seven, you know. And I realized, wow, doing this shit really is good for me. It's fucking, it, you know, it's a pain in the ass. I don't like to do it. It doesn't matter if I like it or not like it. It works anyway, you know, whether I understand it or don't understand it, it works, period, you know. So I was still hesitant and backwards. I couldn't write steps because even though I had won awards for writing in school, I couldn't write about myself. I still can't, but that's okay. I went to therapy on my own decision to get into therapy, and went to therapy for 2 years. And at the end of 2 years, it was clear to me that it was made clear by a really good therapist that it was fine if I couldn't write about the steps. this isn't the work your steps to die motherfucker years, you know? And I had felt like a fake every time I stood up with everybody else and said, work your steps or die, motherfucker. And I'm thinking, well, I ain't working no fucking steps, but I ain't going to die to make you happy. Fuck it, you know. Anyway, so at the end of 2 years, I understood it was okay as long as I figured out how to work them. And I was still in the bullshit deal of you just have to live them. You don't have to write them. And I know today that that's complete bullshit. I wasn't writing them or working them. You know what I mean? So I was bullshitting myself both ways. But at 15 years clean, I had gotten hep C real bad. I had it for 30 something years by that point. And at 15 years, it went south. And I went in to get the interferon, you know, was the only thing they had in those days. And when I went to the I had been in the, you know, in the system, and they said, when you're sick, come see us. I said, okay, I'm sick. And then they said, okay. And they checked it out. They said, you know, you're starting stage 4. And you waited too long. I said, what are you talking about? I'm still working for a living, for Christ's sakes. I work every fucking day, and I'm strong and I'm healthy, you know, but I'm starting to feel bad. I waited till I was sick, like you told me to. Anyway, I screamed and hollered until they said, okay, we'll give you a trial run, 3 months. 3 months down the line, it was evident that the stuff was really working, which was wonderful. But interferon is a drug that used to be a cancer drug, but they stopped using it for cancer patients, even though it worked, because it killed too many of them. But it was the only thing that worked for hep C. So fuck it. Give me that shit, you know, whatever. And after 11 months, it worked. I was undetectable, but I was also out of my motherfucking mind. That stuff makes you nuts, literally, not figuratively, but absolutely literally. And at the end of that, I lost my business, my vehicle, my tools. I lost all my transportation and all my income. And I didn't know what I was going to do. All I knew what to do was to go to meetings. So I was going to meetings, and I had a friend call up, a young guy who was is desperate to get in, get the program. And he says, I need your help. I says, well, what can I do? He says, I need to get to meetings. I need to get to a lot of meetings. I says, oh, that's perfect, Fernando. Call and pick me up every fucking day. We'll go to meetings. And we started to go to meetings. We went to 3 to 5 a day on the weekdays. And on the weekday and the weekends, we'd just live in the rooms. We'd go to 5 to 7 a day on the weekends. So at the end of this period, which I called him up a couple of years ago, and I said, Fernando, maybe 3 or 4 years ago, I called him. I said, Fernando, how long was that period where you were taking me to meetings? I said, was that 3 months, 4 months, 5 months? He says, Dennis, it was a year and a half. So if you want to know what kind of damage that shit does, that interferon, it fucks you up bad, bad. Bad, bad. I could tell you horror stories about friends of mine. You wouldn't fucking believe shit they did when they were on interferon. Anyway, but it worked. Okay, I got clean from Hep C. I stayed clean. I didn't get loaded, and I got through that period. At the end of that year and a half, though, I had an insight as to the operation of a program. What it does, how it does it, why it does it, how to repeat it. And in those days, I wasn't very clear on how to explain it to other people, but I knew that if I understood this and I practiced it, eventually I'd figure out how to tell other people. So that's what I do today. It became clear that night I was on my way to a meeting with one of the truly insane psychopathic lunatics that I've known to this day in the rooms who helped me understand this program. If it changed him that radically, this fucking shit was fucking magic. You understand? I mean, he got clean because he was going to take off his drug dealer with a shotgun. And he goes to the fucking house where his drug dealer is, and he realizes, oh my fucking God, I forgot. This is the building that my uncle owns. He says, if I shoot this motherfucker with this shotgun, it's going to wreck the whole fucking wall. And then I'm going to have to fucking fix it because my uncle's going to make me fucking fix the wall. He's not going to know I shot the guy, but I'm still going to have to clean the whole fucking mess. Man, fuck. And he's thinking, you know, if that's the only reason I can think of not to shoot this fucking guy, there just might be something wrong with me. Huh. And he started at that point to get clean. Eventually, his own wife shot him in the stomach when he was sleeping. This is a genuine fucking psycho, buddy. Everybody on the street hated this motherfucker completely. And yet today, he's one of the nicest guys. He's still a little rough around the edges, I'll tell you that. But he'd come up behind me. I had three kids, and I wasn't too overly employed in those days. But he'd come up behind me and slide a fucking $60 in my pocket, you know, because he knew I was hungry and then didn't have food or whatever. And looking for nothing in return, nothing. No kudos, no you owe me, nothing. Don't worry about it. You'd help me if I was in a bind. Yeah. So we're still good friends to this day, and he's still clean and still nuts, you know. But he works a real good program, you know. So it becomes as if he's a really nice guy. That was one of the clearest indications to me as to how this worked and why I think part of the reason that I think the way I do. In any event, I believe that the product that the program produces, the essential product that the program produces, is humility. And the way to get the humility is through taking actions, humbling actions, you know, and specifically the priority, you know, and that's a program, is a set of humbling actions. So how spiritual is that? Have you ever seen anybody do spiritual push-ups or spiritual jumping jacks? Maybe spiritual squats, you know, who knows, you know, whatever. So if I'm acting my way into better thinking or acting my way into the condition of humility, which is the antidote to egomania, by the way, addicts being egomaniacs with an inferiority complex. Humbling actions reduce or manage to induce some humility in me and reduce the egomania and induce some humility in me. Not much, because I'm not very, very humble, but I know I don't beat myself up over that. That was one of the things I would do early on when I was trying to get this straight. But I don't do that anymore. It's clear when I'm unhumble, like if I'm driving and I get pissed off at somebody in the car, you know, instead of screaming and hollering, and I realize, fuck, I need to do some of this prayer shit. Yeah. And it's another thing that I've learned about. You know, NA is a program of action and prayer. Prayer is an action. Okay. That's why all religions work if practiced. Any one of them, pretty near, except the truly bizarre, insane fucking ones, possibly, work. And they all tell you to pray. They want you to pray to different gods. They want you to pray to different, you know, in different religious beliefs. They want you to pray different prayers, different languages, you know, And then prayer works. That's why they tell you to do it. But it works for reasons other than they think it works. It's strictly a humbling action where I put my hands together and I bow my head and I adopt the posture, the pose of humility. And it's one of those human things that is equal everywhere in the world. Everywhere in the world, this is immediately identified as a humble posture. Okay. And because the reason it is because it actually makes you humble when you adopt this posture. Kneeling down, prostrating yourself before the altar of God, bowing your head, you know, all this stuff actually induces some humility by itself, in and of itself. And the action of prayer, particularly when repeated, which is my two cents to that. But I'm not the origin of that idea. Catholics have rosary beads. Repeat, 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 repeat. An endless series of prayers. Muslims have the worry beads. All religions have ritual practices where they come together on a regular basis, ritually adopting humble postures in groups or singly, whatever you want to do. But it's all assuming the position, okay? Most of you ladies can chuckle about that, but it actually is effective. It actually works when the position is assumed. So operating a program is assuming the position or the posture of humility. And the reason that it doesn't work, supposedly, that it doesn't change us. It changes us temporarily as long as we're maintaining a process that keeps us somewhat humble. It becomes as if I'm humble. Not that I'm really humble. I'm still an egomaniac. Absolutely. No question about it. The disease is incurable. So is egomania, by the way, medically speaking. Egomania, the mental condition of egomania is incurable. What a coincidence, yeah. And it can be arrested at some point, and recovery is then possible. Okay. Operating a program arrests or slows down or mutes the egomania for me, okay? And maintaining the posture of humility by taking program actions, going to meetings, sharing a message, carrying a message to newcomers, allows me to enjoy all the good things in life, because it keeps me more humble than it is even remotely possible for me to be at all without the process. But it's essential to remain in the process, because as if means just that. It doesn't mean I'm humble. It means that from the outside, it looks as though I were humble. I'm taking humbling actions. I'm operating a program. I'm doing the next right thing. I'm carrying this, you know, I'm chairing meetings, going to meetings, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Making phone calls, staying in touch with, sticking with the winners, all of that stuff. I do that all day long, all the time. And it is as though I'm humble the vast majority of the time, you know. I still have my moments, you know. Cut me off in traffic and you'll find a raving lunatic instantly, you know. So I used to beat myself up over that, but I don't anymore. What happens when that happens is I understand that what I need to do immediately to counteract the resurgence of the egomania is work more program. And one of the tickets I use for that is prayer. And how does an atheist fucking pray? Holy shit. How do you get past that one? Well, I pray in Japanese. Nam Myoho Renge Kyo. Nam Myoho Renge. It's an old Buddhist mantra. And what it means in one translation is the law is the jewel in the lotus. What the fuck is that? You know? I actually know kind of what they're referring to, that the series of actions that they want you to take are the actual prize in Buddhism, practicing. And they think the same way I do, frankly. That's what they say at the end of every lecture they give you in the Buddhist temple. Practice, practice, practice. And that's exactly how they do it. Put their hands together, bow their heads, and say, practice, practice, practice. Buddha figured it out 2,600 years ago. You know, so I like to say, how did an Indian holy man become an Indian holy man? He acts like an Indian holy man. He adopts a lotus posture and gets his begging bowl out and sits it in front of him and waits for people to put food in it. He prays all day long. He meditates all the time. And Buddhist monks have in Tibet have taken deliberately studied EEGs, electroencephalograms. That measures the brain waves and such. And they have different brain waves than normal people. They have a very stronger, what they call a theta wave. And when they take, what do you call those damn things? Magnetic scans. I can't think of the damn term. Anyway, when you can see the interior of the brain and their amygdala is enlarged. That's the thing that operates our flight or fight mechanism. And in their case, the amygdala is far stronger than ordinary folks. And the only difference between us and them is that they meditate for 6 or 8 hours a day. Meditation is another form of prayer. So what they're doing is a program of sorts, a primitive program undoubtedly, but definitely an effective program when practiced. Again, lots of Buddhists kill each other right and left all over the place all the time. Look what's going on in Myanmar right now. It's fucking horrifying shit. Anyway, so the bottom line is that the key to this whole picture is the as if. If I maintain the process, it stays as if I'm a clean, recovering addict, and from outside it looks like as if I'm a good neighbor, a good friend, a good sponsor, a good grandfather, a good father, all of this shit. Now I'm a good great grandfather, believe it or not, and. I actually hit 75 a couple of days ago. So, you know, this is all about process. It's the process that's effective. And like myself, if you adopt this process and work at it diligently, it will change everything, change what I thought, felt, and believed. And I really knew this shit didn't work. But just going to meetings, I wasn't taking the fucking suggestions. You know, I was going to meetings once or twice a week, maybe. But even that, over a three-year period, changed what I believed. I started to believe in the program. I never could get a belief in a higher power, though. I still don't like that whole thing. I think that's thinly veiled religion at best. And I don't like it. I don't claim to have any higher powers whatsoever. But I have a process which I follow, quote, religiously. You understand? I operate the process like it's necessary to keep me alive. And it, you know, that's a fact in my case. I still think if I relapse, I'll die in a day or two. The amount of time you have, I think that's important to maintain the time. But I believe that the adoption of the entire process, I started it when I was like 19 years clean, I think. I got into my first step study, and I've been in that step study now. That would be 11 and 7 is 18 years, 18 and a half years. And I'm still working steps every week. You know, I go to a lot of meetings, 2 or 3 meetings a day, as a general rule. This wonderful fucking Zoom thing makes it so easy. And I do a lot of praying and as much meditation as I can get. I meditate and pray while I'm walking the dogs, driving the car, you know. Oh, I can do some of that prayer shit. Cool. Doom, doom. Nam-myoho renge kyo. The whole thing about prayer and repetition, and if you think about it, you know, repetition is the primary operating key to a program. You got to get up and do it all over again every day. Just for today, I work a whole program, all 12 steps every day through my day. You know, I'm aware of this whole process, and I practice it deliberately, intentionally, with the full understanding of what it does and how it does it and why it does it. It's a change in my posture. I adopt a humble posture in my life to the best of my ability. And the point behind all of that that's really important is that if you believe in a higher power, that's fine. It works great if you believe in a higher power. If you work the process. If you don't work the process, there ain't enough higher powers to keep you clean. So it doesn't matter what I think, feel, or believe. It matters what I do. It is an action program. I take these actions deliberately, intentionally, and rigorously, regularly. And boy, it works really, really well. So I don't know if anybody got anything out of that, but I like to tell people what's going on. And I don't often get much in the way of appreciation because it's long, it's boring, and it sounds like nuts to most people. But it is my actual experience. This is not theory. Or this is stuff that I work intentionally and have maintained now for a long, long time and given me greater relief and greater freedom in my life than at any time in recovery prior to that. I feel like I wasted the first 20 years in recovery almost. And So if you're particularly an atheist or somebody who's, I was agnostic when I first got here because I was afraid. I was indoctrinated so heavily into religious belief, and I was the only person I knew of that really, really had a problem with believing. You know, people didn't even talk about it, you know, in those days. It wasn't even like a topic for conversation, you know. But I was so indoctrinated, I was afraid not to believe. But once I understood this about a program, I realized clearly that religion is a primitive program. The function of religion is multifaceted. It's it basically allows for humanity to operate and cooperate with one another. If there's no humility, there's no teaching, there's no need for honesty, there's no need for decency, there's no need for don't touch my shit, you know, there's no need for, you know. Civilization does not work without humility. Period. And the Greeks thought it was all one thing. They didn't believe in the separation of mind and body. And their word for breath and spirit is the same word. And they were the smartest folks that came along up to that point. And I think a lot of what they understood was lost in history. But I'm in that same school, I suppose, I'm equal to any of those ancient Greeks. Don't get me wrong. I'm not that fucking crazy. But I do understand where they're coming from. That the body and the mind are one thing, and they're not separated or different. It's a whole process to heal the whole body and the mind all at one time. Has to all be taken into account. Can't fix one and then get the other one later. It's all tied together. And everything is one thing. The reason, you know, like some of the old things, my strength is as the strength of 10 because my heart is pure. It's humble. My heart is humble. That gives me infinitely more strength than other people. The meek shall inherit the earth. No, it's the humble. It's another word for humble, really. And what's the other one now? Oh, there's a bunch of them. I can't think right now. Tired. But there's a whole bunch of old sayings that if you just put the word humble in there, it all starts to line up and make sense. So anybody can do this, regardless of what you believe or think or feel. Anybody can take these actions and get the same results, despite what they think or despite what they feel. I often say that this works. I work this program despite what I think and despite what I feel. When I feel angry about some asshole cutting me off, that means I need to fucking pray. You know, doesn't mean there's anything wrong with me, that I'm not being a bad person or a fucking loser or have no program. It just means that I'm not operating enough program. And if I pick up my program, it will change the way I think and feel. I'll stop wanting to kill the son of a bitch and I'll start feeling sad for him, you know, that I'm grateful that I'm not him, you know. So it changes what I think and feel. It takes anger and turns it into compassion. And again, anybody can do that. It's a matter of taking the actions. So you can start your day off anytime you want, all over again. You can start your day all over again, anytime at any point in the day. Just start working program. And that's experience again. I do that on a regular basis. Yeah. So develop, if you're new or old, whatever, develop a series of practices that you practice ritually and absolutely actions that you take every day, not thoughts, not feelings, but actions, intentional actions, and see if it don't work. You know, don't take my word for it. I wouldn't. Try it yourself and check it out. And I mean, it works so good. All I have to do is repeat Nam-myoho-renge Kyo most of the time now, 4 or 5 times. And it feels like I can feel my thought process start to change. And I stop being angry, and I stop being hurt, and I stop being upset, and my focus changes, and I start thinking about working more program and getting my shit back together, having a different perspective and the whole package. And it's you got to have a trigger process. I use prayer, which is hysterical because I hated the whole. My first prayers when I first did this shit, I started to believe in it, and other people were doing it, and I thought, man, it's fucking ridiculous. I hate this whole fucking thing. And my first prayers were, I know you'll help me if I'm asking you, so I'm asking you. And it fucking worked, you know. It took like 6 months, you know, for my prayers to, and I stopped believing in it, and I never thought it was going to happen. And then it fucking happened. 6 months down the line, shit worked out, you know, that I knew couldn't work out. I knew it was fucking impossible. There's no way. And then suddenly something happened unexpected and completely out of the fucking ballpark. I didn't know where the fuck it came from, left field, right field. And the shit worked out, you know. It still took me years to put that together. That was before I took the interferon. First times, a couple of times I prayed. But whatever. So I guess we can. Does anybody feel up to asking any questions about any of that stuff? I'll be happy to answer them. Not all at once now. Slow down. Take it one at a time.